Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, the Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on 29 AM and FM radio stations 7 days a week in the United States and in more than 70 countries worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on the appellate court rules against the city of Wenatchee, Washington's misconduct, right after this message. You know, we Americans may hold the dubious honor of being the most litigious people in the world, but when it comes to law, we're among the most ignorant in the world. And that's because those who already walk submissively will say that there's no cause for alarm. But submissiveness is not our heritage. The First Amendment was designed to allow rebellion to remain as our heritage. The Constitution was designed to keep government off of the backs of the people, and the Bill of Rights was added to keep the precincts of belief and expression of the press of political and social activities free from government surveillance. Well, I wished I'd have thought of that, but that quotation comes from Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas. Now, our princes, our politicians, beller in the halls of Congress for more taxes, more spending, and more gun control. But you and I haven't heard anything intelligent come out of a politician's mouth in more than 75 years, and that's why I contend that the only real reason, logic, or common sense left in America comes from our courts, not from our political process. Certainly doesn't come from our politicians, lawyers, or bureaucrats, does it? You know, old Mayor Rothschild summed it up with a flair when he said, "You give me the money power, and I care not who makes the laws." Well, let me add to that, you give me the judicial power, and I care not who makes the laws either, because the real power in America is in our courts, not in our political process. Now, if you'd like to tap into that power of the courts, why don't you call the law school at 417-273-4967, and be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. Now, that's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, educational, informative, and it's free of charge. Now, courtroom strategy and procedure is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, you can go to the website georgegordon.org and click onto the email machine and send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. Well, the appellate court up in Wenatchee, Washington, ruled against the city of Wenatchee for their misconduct in a case that came out of some convictions that were entered in 1995. In brief, the story was something like this. Some people operating a daycare center out of a church were charged with child abuse. And I think there were about 10 or 15 people in the group that were charged. Out of that group, four or five of them pled guilty and went to prison. About 10 of them pled not guilty, were tried and convicted and sent to prison. And then, about 10 years later, the little children grew up. And when the little children grew up, they testified to the truth. They said, "Well, we were brainwashed. We were instructed as to what we were to tell. And those stories weren't true. We didn't do those things, or these people didn't do those things to us." So, some of those convictions were overturned. I think all of those people have been released from prison now. And, of course, some of them have filed civil rights actions against the city of Wenatchee to get compensation for the 5, 10, 15 years that they spent in prison. Well, listen to the story and you make up your own mind. Once again, a court in high standing has shamed the city of Wenatchee, Washington, for deplorable conduct in the wake of the infamous 1994-95 sex child or the child sex ring cases. The State Court of Appeals upheld more than $700,000 in penalties against the city of Wenatchee for withholding key evidence in a civil rights lawsuit brought by the Reverend Robert Robbie Robertson and others. Let me ask you the question. Do you believe that a city would withhold evidence in a criminal trial? Mull that one over a minute. It was the State Court of Appeals that fined the city $700,000 in penalties for withholding key evidence. Do you mean public officials and prosecuting attorneys and city attorneys and lawyers would withhold evidence in a case? I mean, I could see truck drivers and carpenters, plumbers, and electricians doing that because they're a sordid bunch, aren't they? But surely not mayors, city councilmen, city attorneys, and lawyers for the city. They wouldn't do that, would they? Well, kind of mull that one over a bit. We would not presume to give the city's attorneys advice, but should say that local citizens must be growing weary of the repeated disgrace brought by the mistakes of its government and by attempts to cover up those mistakes. The acts that brought this fine are particularly galling. Prior to a previous trial, the city was ordered to hand over the personnel records of Detective Bob Perez. Bob Perez was the chief investigator whose conduct is the focus of the lawsuits. It delivered most of the records, but overlooked a few, which coincidentally contained the information most likely to damage the city's case. Withheld were medical files that may have indicated Perez suffered from mental disabilities, and pre-employment screening files that included a polygraph test. Spokane Superior Court Judge Michael Donahue, who assessed the fine last year, said that he thought the city withheld the information deliberately and that it would have had a significant impact on the trial's outcome. So, not only did the Court of Appeals think that the city acted improperly in withholding this evidence, the trial court judge also thought that the city's actions violated these people's rights. So while the city was on trial for abusing the justice system, it was abusing the justice system. The appeals court agreed that the city's protestations to the contrary were without merit. The city's offense voided the results of a 13-week trial, and whatever your opinion of the merits of the multiple sex ring lawsuits still pending against the city, it is difficult to argue that this kind of action does not deserve sanction. Of course, the fine is potentially only the beginning. Because of the city's offense, there will be a new trial in the lawsuit. The defendants are seeking tens of millions of dollars in damages, and barring an unlikely settlement, all of this evidence, including the evidence in those missing files, will be bared anew. And it shows, if nothing else, the lasting effect of a single mistake. You see, a decade ago, the city's chief of police had an opportunity to take Perez off of these investigations when his unsuitability should have been clear and the legal dangers made obvious. Had that simple move taken place, chances are good that no one would be discussing these cases today. More mistakes followed, though, and now we have no idea how much the aftermath of this fiasco is going to cost the city. It is clear that after a decade, the end of the legal process is nowhere in sight, and it would be best for the city and its battered reputation not to do anything more to prolong it. Now, the sex abuse case to be retried, the court rules, the city of Wenatchee was ordered to pay $718,000 in fines. Now, the State Court of Appeals has upheld a lower court decision restoring a major civil rights lawsuit against the city of Wenatchee over how the 1994-95 child sex abuse investigations were handled. And it ordered the city to pay the $700,000-plus in penalties for their violations of the rules of court. Now, the state court ruled Tuesday that Spokane County Superior Court Judge Michael Donahue did not err when he fined the city for withholding employment records of former Wenatchee Police Detective Bob Perez in lawsuits stemming from the cases. The records indicated that Perez was suffering from a serious mental disability at the time he was conducting the investigations, attorneys have said in court. Donahue also was justified in vacating two earlier jury verdicts and allowing the new civil rights trial to be brought by East Wenatchee pastor Robert Robertson, Hona Sims, and other co-plaintiffs. The ruling also restores Perez and former Wenatchee Police Chief Ken Bagley as defendants. According to attorneys representing Robertson, about $125,000 in interest could be tacked on to the $718,000 Donahue levied against the city in January of 2003. "We're very pleased with the decision," said Auburn attorney Tyler Firkins, who represents Robertson, Sims, Rodriguez, and their families. "We believe that the Court of Appeals strongly stated and agreed with Judge Donahue that the city intentionally withheld documents in violation of the judge's orders of discovery. We feel that the plaintiffs have been vindicated by this decision," he said. In a 13-week trial in 1998, a King County jury found the city and other defendants did not violate the civil rights of Robertson, Sims, and others. The plaintiffs had sought $60 million in damages. In 2001, a Spokane County jury found the city was negligent in the investigation of Robertson and his wife Connie, but didn't award any damages. In his ruling last year, Donahue threw out the earlier verdicts and found Perez's records were intentionally withheld from the court and Robertson's attorneys by the city. The judge said the records were of great importance and could have changed the case's direction. The documents included results of pre-employment polygraph tests and separate medical and State Department of Employment security files. Police officials also expressed concerns about Perez's fitness for duty at the police department, and the record surfaced in 2002 in a separate case. The city argued that it did not intentionally withhold the information and that the action did not hurt the plaintiff's case during the trials. But the state appellate court ruled Tuesday the city's argument is without merit. The violation was substantial, and the withheld files were material to the plaintiff's fair presentation of their case at the time of trial. The state appellate court, consisting of judges Frank L. Kearns, Dennis Sweeney, and Kenneth Cato, wrote that a new trial was the appropriate sanction for the city's willful failure to comply with a court order to turn over the documents. The appellate judges also ruled that Perez and Bagley could still be held as parties to the lawsuit and thus liable for damages. The two had been dismissed from the personal liability during the two earlier civil trials. The city has 20 days to petition the appellate court to review Tuesday's decision or appeal the decision to the state Supreme Court. The city's attorney, Patrick McMahon, said that city officials have not yet received the decision or decided how to proceed. This comes from Jail, J-A-I-L, News Journal, August 11th, 2004. A jail subscriber, Pastor Robert Robertson of Wenatchee, Washington, is one of four readers who can, or one of our few readers, rather, who can praise the ruling of a court in his favor. He sent Jail an opinion written by Wenatchee World newspaper and a report on the case itself. This case has been in the news from the time that it was first initiated by Detective Perez against these 15 people who, as it turned out, were all innocent. It was some kind of a witch hunt on the part of the city of Wenatchee and its police department on the order of Janet Reno's witch hunt against alleged sex offenders in Florida. So it just goes to show you that whenever these big high-profile cases come to light, there is a light at the end of the tunnel. And this seems to be that light. Stand by. We'll be right back. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, Americans today are interrogated, watched, measured, and counted more than at any time in our history. Surveillance and electronic record keeping of nearly every routine activity, from bank deposits to medical visits, has produced greater efficiency and security, all right, but it's also responsible for a very discernible erosion of our ability to live our lives free from outside government scrutiny. Now, the federal government currently maintains an average of 15 files on every American, according to estimates by the Office of Management and Budget. And closer to home, state and local governments use computers to keep their own files on us. And a study conducted by the New York Committee on Open Government found that that state, New York, and its agencies operated 1,776 separate data systems, containing 10,799 categories of information about New York residents. And every one of those systems contained between 2 and 10 million records. Now, would you like to know how government, banking, insurance, business, and industry obtains all of this information? What are their sources? How is it stored? How is it retrieved? What do they want it for anyway? Well, knowing how information is gathered and what information is stored and what information you want to keep personal and private will actually put you in the driver's seat in your quest for privacy. Now, for more information about privacy and privacy issues, why don't you call the law school at 417-273-4967 and ask for my free general law CD package. And let me tell you how to train yourself to be just as personal and private as you want to be. Now, it's educational, informative, entertaining, and free of charge. And all you have to do is call direct 417-273-4967 to order yours. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. If you're online, just go to the website and send an email. That's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and send your email request. Remember, that's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. Well, how does the IRS deal with tax protesters? During the past several years, counsel has experienced a dramatic increase in the number of protest cases which are being docketed, tried, and decided by the tax court. There's been sufficient judicial precedent in both the courts of appeals and the tax court to allow the Office of Chief Counsel to move for summary disposition of certain protester cases. In addition, the tax court has commented in its opinions that protester cases require a disproportionate amount of its time. In view of the foregoing, the following procedures are set forth in order to provide guidelines for the use of summary proceedings to resolve certain of these protester cases. So, I selected this article to show you how the courts are going to deal with your tax protest cases. Now, I'm not in favor of the income tax, but I'm not in favor of tax protest either. Tax protest is simply a one-way trip to jail. That's the bottom line. It doesn't have any legal merit to it. Between 1965 and 84, in that 20-year period, our circuit courts of appeal and U.S. Supreme Court listened to 100 cases a year, about 2,000 cases, and when the dust had cleared, they came to the conclusion that there are three defenses to an income tax case. Three defenses. 1,997 losers and three winners. Three defenses. You can argue religious free exercise, or reliance or subjective good faith. So reliance comes under Murdoch, and subjective good faith under Aikens, and religious free exercise under Seeger. Those are your three winning arguments. Everything else is a loser. Now, that doesn't mean that there someday will not be a fourth winning argument that some ingenious fellow may come up with. But as of this moment in time, a trip to the tax court or the district court will result in summary process or jail. Here's the way it works. First of all, for purposes of this section, a protester case does not include church or family trust type cases. For purposes of this section, a protester case does include a case where the petitioner has refused to pay federal income tax for what are asserted to be constitutional, religious, or moral reasons. Usually, the defense as to the payment or reporting of the tax may be as follows. First, Federal Reserve notes are not money, so they are not income when received. The legal tender or Federal Reserve note argument. That's a dead loser. Number two, the income tax violates conscience, religious beliefs, or moral convictions. That's called the First Amendment approach. That's a loser. Number three, the 16th Amendment authorizing the income tax is unconstitutional. That's a loser. The income tax constitutes prohibited involuntary servitude. It's called the 13th Amendment approach. That's a loser. Number five, filing a return or paying income tax violates the taxpayer's right against self-incrimination and due process. It's called the Fifth Amendment approach. That's a loser. And number six, the income tax law is discriminatory. It's called the 14th Amendment approach, and that's a dead loser. Paragraph 2, there are other possibilities for inclusion of cases within the procedures outlined in this section. If the case presents some form of social, moral, religious, or constitutional objection in generic terms to have operation of the country or the right to tax in general as opposed to questioning the substantive quality of the code, regulations, rulings, and or the determination of the Commissioner of Internal Revenue. If it is necessary to develop a factual pattern by documentary evidence and testimony, then the summary procedures of this section would not be applicable. So, your procedure before an answer. If the petition contains no substantive tax issues and there are no facts underlying the assignment of error, which must be determined or classified by further proceedings, a motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim upon which relief can be granted under Rule 40 of the Tax Court Rules of Practice and Procedure should be filed in lieu of an answer. Now remember, this is the government's response to you because in tax court, you are the petitioner and the government is the defendant. Second, if there is a substantive tax issue and or factual matters to be developed by further proceedings, then a motion to strike assignments of error and allegations of facts with respect to the protest issue should be filed prior to filing an answer. Fourth, after the answer, you should, if an answer has already been filed in a protester case and there are no substantive tax issues in dispute and no facts to be further developed, a motion for judgment on the pleadings or a motion for summary judgment if exhibits or affidavits are attached should be filed. And then next, if a protester case has been answered and it contains no substantive tax issues but requires limited factual development, that which could be accomplished by affidavit or informal methods other than discovery, motion for summary judgment should be filed subsequent to the development of the factual aspects. Next, if a protest case has been answered and contains substantive tax issues in addition to the protest issue, then a motion for partial summary judgment may be filed to resolve the protest issue. It is contemplated that some protest petitioners will not be interested in continuing litigation without the protest issue, and it is recognized that this approach may be more cumbersome than a brief trial and therefore is left to field supervisors' discretion. Next, if there's any doubt as to whether a particular case comes within the definition of a protest case, as defined in this section, the Tax Litigation Division should be consulted prior to consideration of the procedural directives. And next, every effort should be made to provide the court with citations of cases directly on point, especially regular tax court opinions and appropriate appellate court opinions. If no cases are susceptible to citation, use the summary procedure. It may be inappropriate unless the pleading clearly reflects a failure to state a claim upon which relief can be granted. And next, care should be exercised to ensure that the court possesses the correct taxable year and the amount of the deficiency so that a decision may be entered by the court. And next, a legible copy of the statutory notice of deficiency should be attached as an exhibit to any motion filed. In appropriate circumstances, a copy of the return should also be attached as an exhibit. Any reduction to the deficiency shown on the notice must be communicated to the court, as, for example, where the statutory notice contains a mathematical or technical error, or where the respondent concedes a substantive issue. Now, let me give you a couple of pointers here on your tax protest positions. I got a call the other day from a student down in, let's see, it was in Georgia, out around Jekyll Island. He was very concerned about a friend of his who hadn't filed for a number of years and had been teaching tax protest. He also had a wife, and the guy's wife, a chiropractor, who wanted to file but hadn't filed because her husband had objected to her filing, hadn't filed either. Well, they called, the husband did, and he asked me what I thought, and I told him. I said, 94% of the time you're going to lose. 6% of the time you're going to win. And of that 6% of the time, probably you're guilty, but juries, for some reason or another, create a scene called jury nullification. It's not often, but occasionally that does occur. Well, the guy didn't take any action. He was under criminal investigation. And finally, the last I heard, the grand jury met and came down with an indictment. Now, up until that indictment comes down, you can file your tax return, and the minute you file it, you win. The government loses. The arguments that are being used by tax protesters are, in the words of the appellate courts, specious, frivolous, without foundation or merit. Tax protesters, however, believe passionately in the arguments that they have developed, as erroneous as they may be. And I'm not here to tell you that you should or shouldn't file your taxes. I'm just here to tell you that 94% of the time you're going to lose. 6% of the time you're going to win. But if at any time you run down and you file the return, you win. Because now you have not willfully failed to file. It's actually a race to the courthouse to see who can get the first move accomplished. Can you get your taxes filed before the grand jury issues the indictment? If the indictment comes down a minute before you file, you lose. But if you file a minute before the indictment comes down, you win. I mean, after all, you did file. And you filed timely, and you filed at the insistence of the government. Now, whether you owe the government money or not, that's another question, because it's not against the law to owe the government money. It's against the law to beat the government out of their money. Joe Lewis died, and he owed the government $3 million, but he never went to jail. Stand by for more right after this. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, Joe Smith started the day early, having set his alarm clock made in Japan for 6 a.m. And while his coffee pot made in Japan is perking, he puts his blow dryer made in Taiwan to work and then shaves with his electric razor made in Hong Kong. He puts on a dress shirt made in Taiwan, his designer jeans made in Singapore, and a pair of tennis shoes made in Korea. After cooking up his breakfast in his new electric skillet made in the Philippines, he sits down to figure out on his calculator, which is made in Mexico, how much he can spend today. Then after setting his watch made in Switzerland to the radio made in Hong Kong, he goes out and gets in his car made in Germany and goes looking, as he has for many months, for a good-paying American job. Then after the end of another discouraging and fruitless day, Joe decides to relax for a while, so he puts on a pair of sandals made in Brazil, pours himself a glass of wine made in France, turns on his TV made in Japan, and then ponders again why it is that he can't find a good-paying American job. Well, instead of a good-paying American job, why doesn't Joe look for a good-paying American private business dealing in property instead of income? Now, if you'd like to tap into the power of private business, why don't you call and order my free General Law CD package first? Now, that's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's informative and entertaining. It's educational. It's free of charge, and you can call and order yours right now. The number, 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to my website, georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and send me an email request for that free General Law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. Well, here's a story about Walmart. Walmart, as you may have heard, pays low wages. But then so does Burger King and Wendy's and McDonald's and thousands of other retail establishments that depend upon either part-time help or young, inexperienced help. I don't know that Walmart pays everybody $7 or $8 an hour, but it's been reported that they don't have the fringe benefits that many other companies have. They don't have health insurance for all of their employees and so on up the line, and they come under a great deal of criticism for not having all of these amenities. Well, I'm an old-timey businessman, and I can tell you from my business experience that businesses do not exist for the convenience of or for the benefit of their employees. A business exists for the express purpose of making profit. It's the only purpose for business. And if, as a result of that central enterprise, the business provides employment, wages, health insurance, benefits, and other goodies, well, that's just so much the better, but that's not the purpose for its existence. Businesses do not open their doors to employ people. They don't open their doors to provide health insurance for the people that they hire. It's not the purpose for business. It's a collateral issue, not the central issue. Well, the New York Times wrote this article, and it says, Walmart has torn cities apart from Inglewood to Chicago and engulfed the entire state of Vermont. Now the conflict has gone national as a presidential campaign issue, with John Kerry hammering the mega retailer for its abysmally low wages, and Dick Cheney praising Walmart for its spirit of enterprise, fair dealing, and integrity. This could be the central battle of the 21st century. Earth people versus the Walmartians. No one knows exactly when the pod landed on our planet, but it seemed normal enough during the early years of gentle expansion. Almost too normal. If you thought about it, with those smiley faces and red, white, and blue bunting, like the space invaders in the 1950s, when they put on their human suits. Then it began to grow. By 2000, Measures of mere size, bigger than General Motors, richer than Switzerland, no longer told the whole story. It's the velocity of growth that you need to measure now. Two new Walmart stores opening and $1 billion worth of U.S. real estate are bought up every week. Almost 600,000 American employees churned through in a year. That's a 44% turnover rate. So evidently, 44% of Walmart's employees don't like the low wages or the working conditions and they leave. Well, that's almost half. That means that every 2 years, all of the people that work at Walmart find a real job somewhere else. I fail to see the problem with Walmart. You know, I'm just an old country boy, an old businessman, but I don't have any problem with Walmart. Let me tell you a little story. My wife and I were in town some time back, a couple of weeks ago, and the wife needed some things and said, I want to stop at Walmart. So we had our driver stop at Walmart, and she went in. She got a basket full of stuff, and she came up to the checkout counter, and as is my wife's habit, and is Walmart's habit, Walmart steals a lot and cheats a bunch, and my wife likes to catch them. Now, it's nothing personal, but it's just business. And Walmart likes to pride itself with having these low, everyday low prices. Always the low price, always. Remember their ad? Well, the way they work that is Walmart has a sign up over an item and it says $2.49, reduced from $3.10. So my wife notes that down. Then she goes up, and most people, you know, they've got all these things in their cart and they don't pay very close attention. My wife pays attention. And so when that $2.49 item that was reduced from $3.10 comes up with $3.10, my wife said, hold it, hold it, hold it. $3.10 is the wrong price for that. It's $2.49. Well, now the checker has to call somebody to come over and check it, don't they? So they call somebody over and they check it out and they say, well, this Mrs. Gordon is right and it's got to be $2.49. And so they go through the process and they take off the extra 60 cents. So they start checking through it again and they come up with another one over here that's mispriced. And so my wife says, hold it, hold it, hold it right there. That's the wrong price on there. Let's fix that. Well, you know, they got a call. Well, the checkout girl, she got kind of uppity. About the second or third time my wife caught her, she kind of took it real personal. And she got a little snippy with my wife, and my wife said, why don't you stick it where there's no daylight, and turned around and walked out. Now, here's the basket full of goods, and it's half rung up, and you got uppity with my wife, and she says, to hell with you, walks out, and we went to Town and Country and bought the stuff over there. Probably paid more money, but we were happy as clams at high tide. You know, money isn't the only issue in life now, is it? Before Walmart, there was life, wasn't there? And I submit to you that there would be life after Walmart. Well, Walmart will be in trouble long before the year 4004, because my thumbnail calculation suggests that by the year 4004, every square inch of the United States will be covered by a Walmart supercenter, so that the only place left for any new supercenters will be on top of the existing Walmart supercenters. Now, long before that happens, of course, because with everyone on the planet working for the company or its suppliers, hardly anyone will be able to shop anywhere except Walmart. And Walmart is frequently lauded for bringing consumerism to the masses, but more than half of its own associates, as the employees at Walmart are euphemistically termed, cannot afford the company's health insurance, never mind its faded glory jeans. With hourly wages declining throughout the economy, Walmart, the nation's largest employer, is already seeing its sales going soft. Well, that makes sense. I mean, if you're buying this cheap John trash from China And after all, Walmart is the Chinese People's Republic's department store. I mean, that's just where reality's at. Most of what they buy comes from China, the Philippines, Indonesia, or someplace out in the Pacific Rim. And they're selling it to us. So they're hiring people that work for 14 cents or 36 cents or a dollar an hour to make this cheap stuff, to sell it to us because we can afford to buy it because we make $10 an hour or $15 an hour. But as wages decline in the United States, we'll be able to buy less and less. So as the price of gasoline goes up, the Arabs take more of our fuel dollars, which leaves us with fewer dollars to spend at Walmart, and so their sales go soft. The ultimate end to this, can you see this? The ultimate end is when all of the people of America are working for 14 to 36 cents to a dollar an hour, none of us will be able to afford the goods and services that we're buying and importing from the Far East now, will we? Would seem like to me that it's a self-defeating, or put another way, it's a race to the bottom, a self-defeating methodology. We've got a $550 billion a year trade deficit with the rest of the world. And one of these days, those people are going to say, pay me. What are we going to pay them with? The biggest export that America now has is the export of American dollars. We manufacture American dollars, and we spread those all over the world, and we take their tennis shoes and big screen TVs in return. But at some point in time, when those people say, we've got enough dollars, and what we want now are American computers or American machinery, automobiles, what are we going to pay them with? Mull that one over a little bit. I think my wife's solution works a lot better. You just turn around, walk out, tell them to stick it, and it'll send a bigger, better message. Now, in my own brief stint at the company back in 2000, I worked with a woman for whom a $7 Walmart polo shirt of the kind that we had been ordered to wear was an impossible dream. It took us an hour to earn that much. Some stores encourage their employees to apply for food stamps and welfare. Many take second jobs. Critics point out that Walmart has consumed $1 billion in public subsidies, but that doesn't count the government expenditures required to keep its associates alive on their welfare and Medicare payments. Apparently, the Walmartians, before landing, failed to check on the biological requirements for human life on planet Earth. I can't contain myself again. Excuse me, but if you're going to ring Walmart through the ringer, shouldn't you also ring McDonald's and the rest of these minimum wage employers through the ringer also? Is there somebody that's putting a gun to the heads of these people that work at Walmart and forcing them to work there against their will and over their objection? I'd like to refer you back to the 44% turnover rate. Obviously, those people can't make a living at Walmart, and so they leave to go somewhere else, which then leaves the job open for some new person who's evidently out of work and needs a job, even at $5, $7, or $8, or $9 an hour, isn't it? My goodness, I can remember back in the old days when I worked for $250 a month in board and room. I thought that by the time I graduated to $3.27 an hour, that I had arrived in heaven. Today, minimum wage is over $5 an hour, and people that are making $7, $8, $10 an hour don't seem to be able to make it. But did you notice all the Mexicans coming to America? They can make it. Did you notice all the Filipinos and others that are coming over here to take our jobs at $7, $8, and $10 an hour? They seem to be able to make it. What's the matter with Americans? Is it because we've grown old, fat, bald, and happy that we can't compete? Stand by. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. Tonight's report on Kerry's painfully silent outsourcing and trade right after this. You know, under the terms of a contract called the Old Covenant, negotiated by Moses out at Mount Sinai, you and I are entitled to 33 articulable benefits, such as rain in due season, multiplied gold, silver herds, flocks, and great wealth. Well, George Bush has said that what Americans want is jobs, jobs, jobs. But that's not what George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Ben Franklin, Moses, or God had in mind when they wrote our Constitution, Bill of Rights, and the Ten Commandments. These authorities all recognized that real wealth is measured in land, cattle, property, gold, silver, wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil. It's not measured in employment, and it's certainly not measured in jobs, jobs, jobs. And that's because there's no money in employment. The money is in private business and sales, not in public business or jobs, jobs, jobs. Now it's time that you cashed in on your inheritance and learned how to collect those benefits of the old covenant contract and collect those benefits in gold, silver, wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil. We call that real property instead of credit, debt, usury, inflation, and worthless paper. Now if you'd like to learn how to do just that, why don't you call for more information on my CD Homeschool for Adults, and then order my free General Law CD package at the same time. Remember that General Law CD package is free of charge. It's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's informative, it's entertaining, educational, and it's free of charge. You can call and order yours right now. The number's 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, go to the website georgegordon.org. Click on to the email machine and send me an email request for that free General Law CD package. That's georgegordon.org. Do it right now before you forget. And you can call direct, 417-273-4967. Do it right now before you forget. Well, John Kerry has been painfully silent on the outsourcing of American jobs and our continued trade deficit. You know, every conversation that I've had in the last several weeks contains at least one expression of dread, with the basic theme being, how can John Kerry be 10 points behind this guy George Bush? Indeed, you wonder how objective conditions could be so unfavorable to the incumbent, such as job losses, health care costs skyrocketing, record consumer debt, and federal deficits, not to mention the little matter of Iraq. Well, Kerry's troubles started long before August, and I remember walking out of the Democratic convention in Boston left cold by Kerry's acceptance speech, because he barely mentioned the one issue that had roiled American public opinion for more than 2 years, and that was the outsourcing of American jobs and trade. He devoted just 7 sentences to the issue that had sparked outrage across the country, energizing a broad spectrum ranging from thousands of workers to CNN's Lou Dobbs. He let his most valuable attack line and a key bridge to undecided voters slip away. I wonder if he let it slip away, or if maybe he just ignored it because he's a fellow skull and bones kinsman to George Bush. Now, if you need independent verification for this squandered opportunity, look no further than the New York Times CBS poll conducted for the Democratic and Republican conventions. The poll sought to illustrate the differences on issues between the two parties' delegates, and then where the two parties' delegates stood on issues relative to their rank-and-file voters and the general voting population. Well, the poll results were fairly predictable, with the two parties' delegates split decisively on virtually every issue, and rank-and-file voters of each party separated by a significant margin. Now, except for one, trade, the New York Times CBS poll presented the statement, quote, "Free trade must be allowed, even if domestic industries are hurt by foreign competition," unquote. Well, 53% of Republican delegates agreed. But once you get beyond the foot soldiers, the polling reveals something very different. Only 25% of Republican voters agreed with the statement, and a fact which puts them in the company of Democratic rank-and-file voters at 26%. And all voters at 27%, even Democratic Party delegates polled in at 23%, implying that large union representation among the Democratic Party's delegates only makes a slight difference on this issue. No one should be surprised by the numbers. If you're a person whose job has been torn away in the past decade or so by what's known as free trade, or if you live in a town that has lost its factories and tax base because of NAFTA, your reaction to a poll question on free trade will be so visceral, it doesn't matter whether you're a Republican or a Democrat. You would forget the cultural wedge, you know, cultural wedge issues like guns, abortion, gay marriage, that might obscure the economic realities that bind so many workers, because all you would remember at the moment that you answered the poll question are the bills that you can't pay or that can't be paid, or the personal stories of people that you know, perhaps your own story, who have lost out to global competition, which pits workers against one another. Well, let me pause right here and make an editorial comment. Can you explain to me how free trade benefits America? Think about it for a moment. Let's let China pay 14 cents an hour to a worker to make a big screen TV, and then let's let Walmart import that big screen TV to the United States and sell it in a Walmart store, and tell me how that benefits you. And you say, well, I can buy it for less money than I would have to pay if I bought a General Electric or a Motorola TV. And you know you're right. You're right. But excuse me, boys and girls, let's go back to Economics 101. If you buy your big screen TV from China, then doesn't that put an American worker at General Electric out of work? And doesn't that employ some guy over in China? You know, boys and girls, if you stop and think for a minute, free trade benefits everybody in the world except Americans. Free trade is wonderful for third world countries that are striving mightily to raise their citizens' standard of living and to bring that standard of living that Americans enjoy to the people of Malaysia and Singapore and China, Japan and the Philippines. It's very laudable and very noble. But those people working for 14 cents an hour, boys and girls, don't buy Cadillacs, Chevrolets and Dodges, do they? Those people who are earning 14 cents an hour aren't buying American computers, are they? You know, it's time that we woke up and paid attention to reality. You know, it's time to wake up and smell the coffee. Now, do you remember that little guy, you know, with the big ears? Back in 1992, said he was opposed to free trade. Remember Ross Perot? I mean, that crazy lunatic from Texas. And he said this NAFTA and GATT is a joke. He ran for president. But I noticed that the American people resoundingly elected Bill Clinton in place of Ross Perot. Do you remember that story? All right. Now, you people listening to me right now are the American electorate. Now, either one of two things. Either one, you made a mistake in 92 when you elected Bill Clinton, or you did not make a mistake and free trade is the way you wanted to go. Bill Clinton is the guy that gave you NAFTA and GATT. I mean, let's grow up and get real. Then in 1996, you had another choice to make. And a guy by the name of Forbes, do you remember that? Steve Forbes. He said, what we Americans need over here is a flat tax. And Americans went to the polls in 1996, rejected Steve Forbes, and you elected Bill Clinton again. Now, I'm not here to second guess your decision, but I am here to tell you that this is a decision that you people made. And when you made it, you got to live with the results of it. Free trade has never been of any benefit to an American at any time. And the argument that I can buy a Japanese Toyota for less money than I can buy a competing American car is your answer to the race to the bottom. Because every time we buy a foreign piece of goods, it means that there is another American that didn't get to make that piece of goods for you. You're employing the Chinese, you're employing the Malaysians and the Filipinos, and that's wonderful, and thank you very much for doing that. But at the very same time you're doing that, you're destroying America's economy. And in the process of doing that, it's either one, you're going to have to compete with 14 cent an hour labor. And you say, well, I can't do that. Well, then why don't you quit buying these foreign goods? Now, personally, I think that we should have a national policy, the same national policy that was enacted by our founding fathers in 1787 that said America first and to hell with everybody else. I know it's a totally self-centered, selfish political policy. But that policy was America first and to hell with everybody else is what made America the richest, most powerful nation in the world. And we ran our government on the taxes that we charged to the foreigners who wanted to sell their goods in the American market, and we made them sell their goods at a higher price than American goods so that they could not compete effectively with Americans. Now, starting with Franklin Roosevelt back in the 1930s, we began to change that policy. You know, your politicians came to you and said, well, listen, here's what we need to do. And you believed them, and you followed that policy. Well, now you've gotten to the end of the policy. Now you've got Walmart, the biggest retailer in the world, selling Chinese goods in the American marketplace for less and less money. And in order for you people to afford to buy that stuff, you have to buy it on your credit cards because you don't have the money. It takes two of you now to work to make a living that my dad could make in 1955 by himself. I mean, that's just where reality is. Free trade has never benefited a single American one time in the last 75 years. It benefits the foreigners. It benefits those corporations, the multinational corporations like Walmart. They benefit handsomely from it. General Motors is now building automobiles in China. Excuse me. Can you explain to me how General Motors, building an automobile plant in China, employing Chinese workers, and selling those automobiles around the world, benefits one single American? Can you explain that to me? Can you tell me how outsourcing our jobs around the world benefits a single American? Write me an email, would you? Send me a letter, and I'll put it on the air. Meanwhile, back at the farm where reality comes into play, it's time for you and I to recognize that outsourcing of our jobs and allowing other people to sell their goods in our marketplace does not benefit us one iota. It never has. It doesn't now, and it's not going to in the future. And I don't care who you vote for. You can vote for the red death pill or the green death pill. You're going to get more outsourcing, and you're going to get more free trade, but it's not going to benefit you. Now, that's the bottom line. All right, you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States and worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Gordon Law School and The Law Hour, please go to the website georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log schedule and our archive, and it can be accessed through my website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Well, I gotta go. We'll see you next time right here on The Law Hour. God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.